Coming up on Fronteras, the Big Bend region has one psychiatrist. And this isn't a rare situation in Texas.
The border and rural areas have far fewer number of mental health professionals per capita.
We examine why the state's facing a critical shortage of mental health care workers. In the second half of the program, we speak to San Antonio artist Cruz Ortiz. For him, culture is everything.
Culture's huge. And people don't really, I think, treasure it as much as we really should. Culture is everything that, you know, we wake up to. We smell it. We feel the warmth of it. We experience it as we walk through a street.
Cruz Ortiz on his in-your-face Tex-Mex art, new exhibit, and more. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. There's a critical shortage of mental health care workers in Texas, and the problems especially apparent in the Borderlands region of West Texas. A bill passed last year is trying to tackle the problem. It called for a report on the reasons behind the shortage and recommendations for how to move forward. But as Marfa Public Radio's Paige Phelps reports, for mental health care workers in the field, changes can't come soon enough.
I'm Dr. Stuart Crane. I'm a psychiatrist.
Dr. Crane, who practices from his home outside Alpine, is the only practicing psychiatrist living in the Tri-County area. Brewster County alone, for example, is three times the size of Delaware. His isn't an extreme case, isolated to just far West Texas. There's a shortage of mental health providers throughout the Lone Star State.
There's an uneven distribution of mental health professionals concentrated mostly in the metropolitan areas. The border and rural areas have far fewer number of mental health professionals per capita.
That was Christine Mann, press officer for the Texas Department of State Health Services. She explained that the majority of Texas counties, 207 counties out of 254, are designated health provider shortage areas. Those areas have a ratio of 30,000 people to just one psychiatrist.
That's a lot of people.
In response to this critical shortage, State Representative Cindy Burkett of District 113 in North Texas authored Bill HB 1023. The bill requires the Department of State Health Services to outline the reasons for the shortage and provide feasible policy recommendations on how to alleviate the problem. The report is due to the governor, lieutenant governor, and legislature on September 1st.
Start out with telling me your name and your title.
Hortensia Garcia, Frontier Mental Health Manager.
Hortensia, or Tessie, Garcia, is manager at the Permian Basin Community Center in Alpine, a nonprofit funded by the state. Part of its mission is to provide support for children and adults with mental illness. She can see anywhere from 6 to 30 patients a day, patients who live in a service area of more than 20,000 square miles. Garcia has a few ideas as to why it's hard to recruit to rural and border areas.
I think there's more opportunities in bigger cities, more money, and also psychiatrists. I think that was one of the problems we had. Nobody wanted to live out here when they could make more money somewhere else.
HB 1023 policy recommendations do address new recruitment methods, but the Federation for Texas Psychiatry says the report gives short shrift to what they feel are critical matters like financial incentives and better benefits. Dr. Crane in Alpine is vice chair for education for the Federation.
You're not going to recruit doctors very well if you tell them they only have 10 days of leave, and if they stay with the company a long time, perhaps, you know, that might be more later on.
Deputy Mental Health Officer Mark Davis works with Garcia in Alpine. He says it's not just the problem of not enough mental health professionals and not enough pay. It's a resource issue. At 2 in the morning, when they are trying to stabilize a patient in crisis, Garcia and Davis both say they have limited options in front of them.
If a person needs involuntary care, or they're not cooperating, the nearest facility is Big Spring State Hospital, and it is 205 miles. And many times, today for example, they are on full diversion, which means they are not accepting patients.
Unfortunately, this problem isn't going to get better anytime soon.
We put it in the hands of the legislature, and they will meet in January of 2015. They'll most likely take a look at it, and it could be possible that more legislation gets passed in helping alleviate the mental health shortage. But that's, you know, really up for them to study and to decide.
All of which leaves mental health professionals frustrated.
It makes a stressful job even more stressful.
For Marfa Public Radio, I'm Paige Phelps.
Texas Democrats are in Dallas for their convention this weekend. Democratic Party Chairman Gilberto Hinojosa told Shelley Koffler of member station KERA the goal of the convention is to pump up party activists who will help elect Democrats. And Hinojosa said it's an opportunity to shine a spotlight on the candidates at the top of the ticket.
For the first time in the history of the Democratic Party, the two keynote speakers are going to be women. Wendy Davis running for governor and Leticia Vanderpute running for lieutenant governor. And their message is a message that I believe is in line with mainstream Texans, what they want for their families, a good public education, access to health care, good paying jobs, taking care of their environment, making sure that women are treated equally in this state.
I know you've heard the speculation that Republicans are going to sweep the statewide elections again this fall. Do you really think you can win statewide at this point?
We can win statewide races. We believe we will win statewide races. Look, I campaigned with Ann Richards in 1990 when she ran for governor. She was way down in the polls, and she ended up winning the election. It's all about, you know, having the candidates that are willing to get out there and pound on the pavement and go see people and energize the base. And we've got the candidates that can do this. We also have a different party organization than we've ever had before. I mean, I have 70 or plus, maybe close to 80 people out in the field today that will work for the Democratic Party. On top of all of that, you've got Battleground Texas. You've got a lot of the unions nationally have come into Texas to help organize. You're seeing a lot of nonprofit organizations out there registering voters.
There was a lot of debate over party platform issues at the Republican convention. What do you expect to be in the Democratic platform?
Our Democratic platform will, for example, have a strong public education plank, which will say we need to ensure that public education is adequately funded. It will have a mandatory pre-kindergarten education program. We're going to have a strong pro-women plank that shows we're here because we believe that we should have adequate funding for women's health care, that women should be able to control the decisions involving their body, that we should ensure that women get equal pay for equal work, and that policies of government are not taking us back to 40 years on issues that we thought were all long over, like the Republican Party wants to do today.
And what about immigration?
Our party platform will say what it has always said, is that we believe in comprehensive immigration reform. We believe that it's our obligation to ensure that these hardworking, undocumented immigrants who have been here for many, many years, working, providing for their families, paying taxes, have an opportunity to have a path to citizenship. We want to make sure that these dreamers, these children that were brought to the United States to through no choice of their own, who have grown up as Americans in every sense of the word, have the opportunity to obtain the legal status and ultimately have a path to citizenship as well. Party platform of the Republican Party says deport everybody and the hell with it. And that's just not what America is all about. And so that's going to be a big contrast. And I think it's going to affect substantially the attitude of a lot of Hispanics have towards Republicans.
That was Shelley Koffler of North Texas's KERA speaking to Democratic Party Chairman Gilberto Hinojosa. For the past year, an exchange student from the Philippines has been living in San Antonio. She's deaf, and she's had an impact at Marshall High School. The school is going to offer American Sign Language as a course. TPR's Joey Palacio sat down with her and her host family to talk about her experience in the United States.
I'm Nicole.
Hello. Hi. Nice to meet you.
18-year-old Nicole Lynn Sangan came to the United States from the Philippines in August of last year under a desire to see the world.
Now, I wanted to travel. I wanted to see what America was like, and so I came here. Last year, my friend, she had been an exchange student, and then she told me all about it, and I wanted to become an exchange student also.
That's Rhoda Hockett, a sign language interpreter with Northside ISD. Nicole was born deaf due to her mother having chickenpox during pregnancy. Like Nicole, her San Antonio host family members were all born deaf as well. Carol Ann Broderson is Nicole's host mother. She's able to speak on her own. Broderson says that she was approached by a friend of hers to become a host to Nicole.
She sent me a message saying, hey, you know, are you? They're looking for a deaf family for the deaf girl coming. Are you interested? And I didn't even think about it. I was like, oh. I mean, what was that? 10 minutes later, someone was at my door. And the minute she got off that plane, I mean, she was bonded to us.
At first, Nicole says that there were a few culture shocks, especially around food and people.
I thought it was going to be like Mexico. I thought, you know, and I saw all these people had looked Mexican and they ate Mexican food, which is different from the Philippines. Because in the Philippines, we eat rice.
Broderson says initially she bought rice under the suggestion from another friend before Nicole arrived to make her feel more comfortable. However,
we're showing her, okay, here's your rice. And she looks at us like, I want it away from that. I don't want any rice. You're like, sorry. Well, then she goes straight for the refrigerator. She opens the refrigerator and just looks and looks and then turns around and goes, I like. So, I mean, and I finally asked her, so what do you want to eat? And she's like, I want hamburger, pizza, french fries, and Fruit Loops.
Between the two countries, Nicole says that there are even differences in sign language.
FSL, Filipino Sign Language, is a little more gestural. Yeah, like the sign for dad in American Sign Language is an open hand on the forehead, and the sign for dad in the Philippines is showing sort of a mustache across the top of your lips.
Her stay got off to a bumpy start. Nicole had been going to a school for the deaf, so the transition to Marshall High School was a little difficult.
I was surrounded by people who didn't know sign language. You know, communication was difficult. You know, if I'm with deaf people, it's fine. I could gesture, I could get along, but having to write back and forth to people who didn't understand me.
Gabriella Wolfenberger, Nicole's inclusion teacher, also being translated by Hockett, says after Nicole arrived, the other deaf students at campus began wanting to create a club for American Sign Language, which caught the attention of other students.
The hearing students heard about it and just flocked. I think at the first meeting they had just a few kids, and then it grew and grew and grew to the room wasn't big enough. They had to move to the library to accommodate all the kids who wanted to learn sign language.
The club helped Nicole feel more at home, and Wolfenberger says the principal took notice.
He loved what was going on there, and I guess it gave him the idea to set up ASL classes. ASL is a foreign language at Marshall High School for next year.
About 200 students have already signed up for the class for next year. Nicole came to the U.S. as part of an exchange initiative known as the YES Program through the State Department. Connie Kuchu, a regional manager with AUSA, a nonprofit organization that matches students with host families, says the YES Program was designed to bring students from predominantly Muslim countries to the U.S.
It was kind of in response to 9/11. We had had students come from the former Soviet Union before on the FLEX program. They saw that having youth come over and experience American culture, it helps for stereotypes to be broken.
Currently, there are about 85 students in the U.S. under the YES program. Nicole will not be here for the next school year. Although she's sad to leave, Nicole says she's ready to go home and share her experiences. Joey Palacios, Texas Public Radio News.
There's more Fronteras coming up. A candid conversation with San Antonio artist Cruz Ortiz, whose bicultural upbringing shapes his art.
Culture's huge, and people don't really, I think, treasure it as much as we really should.
Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. San Antonio artist Cruz Ortiz has an art show called Te Quiero A Lot, Mamacitas on display right now at the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center. Ortiz's art has been on display around the world, including in France, Ireland, and Puerto Rico. He stopped by the Texas Public Radio studio this week to talk about his latest work and more. So how would you describe your artwork?
You know, I don't. The more I do things, it becomes apparent that I'm super hyper, I guess, and I just make things. I have a lot of concerns, whether they're political, you know, emotional, or even, different things that I like to address. I like to, you know, include those in the works. So it becomes, you know, someone who makes something with meaning. So
I've heard it a Rescuache approach.
Yes, that's kind of my more comfortable way of producing work. Because I,
what
you know,
does that mean?
Well, Rescuache is a term that I think, you know what? I don't even know where it comes from, but I definitely know that it's South Texas. And it's essentially making do with what you've got. So, for example, growing up, my friend's car, we were driving in his station wagon and the muffler falls off, right? So his dad, and we're freaking like, what? The muffler fell off and it's like dragging, make a bunch of noise. The dad doesn't sweat, gets out of the car, side of the road, takes off his belt, gets in the car and rigs it up to where it's up and running. And they were, I was just amazed, like, wow. And to this day, like when I think about a Rescuache moment or, you know, some sort of happening that, you know, where you're using what you got, I think of that exact moment.
So how does that go with your art?
With my art, a lot of times, like when I first started doing work, it was very clean. You know, I tried my best to keep clean edges and make everything perfect, like, you know, right layers of gesso. And did that, and it just wasn't my thing. I didn't understand it. I could never, there was no appeal to me visually or even in the practice of making it. So my approach has always been, like, I have 10 thumbs and I just do it. There's also another thing that comes with Rescuache, or even that method of working, is this aesthetic of a sense of urgency. And that's something I've always kind of tagged onto. A curator once said, you know, was talking about my work, and she was the one who was like really adamant about it. Like, no, I think he's always like this in a state of emergency to get the work done.
So what is your favorite medium? What do you use the most?
It's been printmaking. I think that's the one thing that I always go back to. I've done everything from, you know, live, you know, performance art to videos to working on a 7-year epic film project. I've done oil paint. I'm recently doing lots of oil paintings. I've done, you know, all kinds of mixed media projects where they're drawing. Or I've also done public art, temporary public art, where it's just working with cities or entities to make entire projects, such as at the Pearl, we have the Echele Latino Music Styles, which is something that Pearl came to me to help develop. So there's all kinds of different projects.
So tell me about this current exhibit.
This current exhibit at the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center is really special. I think when I think about, you know, the Guadalupe itself, it's an incredible legacy. It's always nice to go back home, you know, just to self-reflect, to understand where I've been, all of these other places, and it's nice to come back to get a grip on, you know, what I've done. So,
how did your upbringing in Texas? I mean, your work is very Tex-Mex,
right?
How do you think your culture plays into your work?
Culture is huge, and people don't really, I think, treasure it as much as we really should. Culture is everything that, you know, we wake up to. We smell it. We feel the warmth of it. We experience it as we walk through a street. And that's something that's always been, you know, especially going on these other different places, you come back and you realize, wow, that's a tire shop with cool hand, you know, painted letters. Wow, that taco is a truck driver taco. It's got, you know, chorizo, egg, beans, and potatoes. Like, what? On a big old fluffy flour tortilla. Like, that doesn't happen everywhere else in the world or the universe. So, you know, those kind of things you start to appreciate. And I think, you know, it's the job of, you know, artists to always reflect and push those things out.
So how has that Tex-Mex culture that comes out through your art been received around the world?
I think it's a lot of people receive my work as, first, immediate, it's very it's very in your face. I think it's text. It's sometimes a lot of it's, you know, typography type of visual issues, and then you start to look at the poetry behind it, or these sayings that you would remember hearing, you know, your grandma say, or your crazy uncle, because everyone has that crazy uncle, or, you know, or you see that image that looks familiar that you've seen on street signs. I think those are things that people connect to right away, and not just in Texas. I've had people from, I mean, I had a show in Liverpool, of all places, and they knew about it. They knew exactly what I was talking about. And I tell them, you know, a lot of the things that One of the other underlying things of my work is dealing with the idea of romance, this romantic drive to get the one you want. And that, again, comes a lot from, you know, my issues of being a Latino in the United States, especially in this hot spot of South Texas, which is like on the map right now, of course. But you see all these different issues pop up, you know, and people can relate to that, even through, like for example, music. You know, I can have heartbreak like Merle Haggard and Vicente Fernandez at the same time.
You know, you have words, you do use text a lot, and there's mamacita, chula, amorcita. Is this exhibit about love?
It's always about love. A lot of the work stems from a lot of the work that I did as a doing performance art earlier on. I work at a high school. There was a lot of immigrant children coming in. And just hearing their stories of just like in the trunk or in a car seat, and like in a dashboard, like, what? You got here how? Or I had a kid who said, sir, I know the way. I've been doing it for seven times. Like, I've done it seven times. I'm like, what do you mean you know the way? And he's like, I know the way. I'm like, wow, this guy knows the way. Like, he knows where all the ranches to go through, like where there's clean water. Like, what? So this idea of just people, you know, doing whatever it takes to get to there. It's like the Marvin Gaye song, you know, through mountains or rivers, and like, I got to get to you, you know, and that kind of thing resonates. You know, there's a relationship of humans wanting something. And I think, you know, a lot of love songs do that. And yes, that's what the show's about, is people wanting to get something better.
Cruz Ortiz, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
No problem. Go Spurs.
San Antonio artist and Spurs fan Cruz Ortiz has an art exhibit, Te Quiero A Lot Mamacitas, at the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center through next month by appointment. He invites people to check out his art on his Facebook page, Cruz Ortiz Art. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations all along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past Fronteras shows online at tpr.org. If you want to share these stories on social media, there are one-click buttons to Facebook and Twitter. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.